going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is The Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Youth fentanyl overdoses on the rise in Montgomery County. Racist symbols found at schools, affordable housing, and more. We're sitting down with Montgomery County Executive Mark Elridge. He's answering our questions and yours. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. County Executive, thank you so much for coming in.
And thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Let me get right to the meat of some of the latest news issues. As I said, there was a report of a 15-year-old Montgomery County Public School student who died last week as the result of a fentanyl overdose. Talk to me a little bit more about this particular incident and also what you're seeing in the county. The superintendent talked a lot about this as well as the chief last week.
This incident, you know, is really painful, but it's not the only one. And we're losing children and young adults and older adults as well. There's something different about how people feel about their place in the world that seems different from like my earlier experiences in life and probably different than your earlier experiences. There were always, you know, some people who would, you know, be involved in drugs, and there were always overdoses. It seems much more prevalent. It seems more widespread in the community. And it's just so hard to figure out where do you see the signs first? How do you intervene early? What do you need to know to try to keep, you know, how to help these kids from going where they're going with this? And it's just scary because you don't know. You don't know where or when to intervene.
These are children. In this particular case, we're talking about a 15-year-old, and I know that the superintendent, Dr. Monifa McKnight, is going to be hosting this fentanyl meeting at Clarksburg High School later on this month. But even ahead of that, this didn't just start happening last week. What is your understanding about what's going on with children in the Montgomery County Public School System?
Well, I don't know if you could extrapolate it to all children in the system, but I'll say that, you know, the COVID disconnect is a real thing. And the lack of socialization and the lack of things that contribute to normal social emotional growth kind of got short-circuited by COVID. And I think added to that is we know there's learning loss. And I don't think we think about the psychological side of learning loss. It's one thing for us as adults to say, yeah, there's learning loss. I can measure it. Here's a chart. It's another thing to be a student who sits in a classroom and feels like they don't know what they're being told. They can't keep up with the lessons. And it begins to reflect on their own view of themselves. There's something wrong with me. And so I've always felt, even because I was a teacher, and, you know, I was very conscious of trying to make students who were struggling not feel that this was an internal problem, but rather this was a lack of opportunity or lack of things that people had, you know, previous experiences to get you where you needed to be. And I think we've got all these things compounding in kids, and then the ready availability of things that'll kill you. And that we didn't have when we were growing up.
And that's exactly what I was going to say, because we're not talking about, air quotes, a little weed here. Mm-hmm. I think I, even as a kid, even because I didn't smoke because I didn't like cigarettes, so I didn't smoke anything. But even my contemporaries when I was in high school, and even, I'm dating myself, junior high school, some of them may have smoked marijuana, but when it came to things like heroin, because that was the big, they were afraid of that. But it just seems that considering where we are right now with fentanyl, and I'm just talking about the children, that they know that it's deadly, and yet it's still happening.
Well, it's not altogether clear that they always know they're doing fentanyl. Because, you know, one of the conversations, you know, I was actually having a conversation today about that people have pill presses. They can, you know, get a hold of a press that will take a compound and put it in the shape, color, if need be, of the standard pill. So you might think you're doing another drug, Adderall, or, you know, any name your other pill that you might want to take. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's not that it's been laced with fentanyl. And the thing that infuriates me is the people who lace this stuff with fentanyl.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not just dealing with fentanyl addicts. They're taking people who are not fentanyl addicts and selling them a drug that they think is something else, and they wind up with it with fentanyl. So I wish there was enough of a reward program out there to get people to turn in the people who are dealing in fentanyl, frankly.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking with Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich about all things Montgomery County. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. We will take it. Let's start with Lamont, calling from Frederick, Maryland. Lamont, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, how you doing? Good evening. My concern is, I'm 54 years old. I grew up in Montgomery County, went to Kennedy High School, and I met Honorable Mr. Ehrlich at person with disabilities. I'm a Navy Iraq War veteran, so I met him years ago. I appreciate his service to our county. My concern is the crime, and I had to leave Montgomery County because of crime in Germantown and a lot of teenagers and mingling and hanging around, soliciting. And it's very unfortunate because a lot of people are leaving Montgomery County to go out, you know, Frederick County and outside the area. And I just wish that they had more impact with volunteerism, which I've tried to do with Montgomery County schools. And it's disappointing because a lot of times they don't allow volunteers before COVID to speak to the kids and engage and tell a story of myself being in trouble in the 80s, not going to school. But then I did graduate and have 3 degrees. I'm a veteran. Retired. So I wish they would have initiative for Montgomery County, state of Maryland, where we can have those who earn degrees and those who are in trouble go and have a day of volunteerism where we have pep rallies for sports. Why don't I have a pep rally for those who care about the next era, the next future?
Well, Lamont, let me see if the county executive can respond to your comment.
I will tell you that, you know, I've had other people who wanted to volunteer and sometimes found it difficult to be able to volunteer. Organizations who want to bring services and for whatever reason they're not able to provide services, often at little or no cost to what would be the school system or the county. And I think we've got to rethink how restrictive we've been. Sometimes I feel that departments like risk management make it difficult for people to make contracts and work with other groups, and we may be overdoing the risk management to the detriment of providing services to people who need to have risks prevented. And that's, you know, one thing that we're looking at. I have literally talked to more than one person from more than one group that said, we'd like to help. How do we do it, and how do we help? Can I help you get in? So I think we do have to do a better job of taking the hands that are reaching out to us and find ways to plug them into the system, particularly since we know we don't have the staffing in terms of mental health professionals. They are scarce in the market. It's not like we're not paying. It's not like we're not competitive, but there is a lack of people willing to step forward and do this kind of work. Until we can solve the supply of professionals, we need to lean, I think, more on community members who are trying to help.
Mm-hmm. Lamont, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Carol calling from Montgomery County. Carol, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Carol, are you there? Carol, give
Hello?
Us a... Yes, go right ahead. What's on your mind?
Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
So I couldn't really hear what you were talking about right beforehand, but as soon as I heard the message about fentanyl, I felt that I needed to say something.
Sure.
As someone who works in school, And so we really need to revamp how we address this whole issue, especially since it is affecting our young people, which means it changes our communities and it changes society. And it can be a change that's permanent if we don't take the reins on this to turn this around. I'm in schools every day and I see what's happening and it needs to be addressed. It can't be business as usual. And we have to take accountability for what is happening in terms of criminal activity happening in schools. We need SROs back in the building to address this. We need to hold parents accountable for things that their children do in terms of having drugs and behaviors. Schools really have their hands tied, and there's not much they can do.
I was going to say, why don't we let the county executive respond to what you've shared with us already? You said quite a bit. Please go right ahead.
So, I mean, my first thing would be just the question of what do you see that actually see that you think is actionable? Is it a perception or do you actually see things that somebody ought to do something about? And I'm not saying they don't happen, but I'm curious as to what that side of the experience is. Second, there are SROs in schools. They've been there for a year now. They're not in the role they were in before, and it's actually had some real benefits for us. But it's this is more than having an SRO in a building. An SRO in a building is not going to detect the myriad of problems and, to some extent, the dealing that goes on, because people aren't going to deal in front of an SRO. They're going to go to a bathroom, a stairwell, or someplace else. So I'm interested in what you see, but I think we do need a more robust response. And if we're seeing things that we should act on, we should figure out how we should act on them then.
Real quick, Carol, just share with us one thing as it relates to your observations in your capacity as a school employee.
Kids are coming to school under the influence.
Interesting. Thank you, Carol. Thank you so much for your input. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking to Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich about all things Montgomery County. If you have a comment or a question, lines are open. Give us a call. The other thing that has also come up, I wanted to ask you about the swastikas incident that we saw or heard reported in two schools. Have you seen these examples? Have you seen photographs? Because again, kind of harkening back to the old days. I can't say good old days or bad old days, but just the old days. If you sit at a desk, you see all kinds of crazy stuff scratched into a desk. I'm assuming this is not that.
I think there was some of that, but there's also these pamphlets that were delivered to people. And the pamphlets were very explicit and interesting because the theme was slavery. And it was basically Jews were the causes of slavery, and it listed Jewish names and what they did. And on the one hand, Jewish people, like every other religion, took part in slavery. There's nobody's hands who are clean in this. And that's a fact of life, but they certainly weren't the driving force in this. And it was just a litany of things that were accusations toward the Jewish community. So it's not our first incident. The other ones had different tones. We've had hate incidents leveled against black churches. Mm-hmm. This is crossing multicultural dimensions in terms of attacks on people. And we all know there was a president to basically turn people loose to express all the rage and hatred that their brains had unfortunately been infected with, most likely by their parents.
Do you have any idea where these pamphlets came from?
Not yet. We're looking. If we knew, we would go shut it down and we'd find the people responsible. We've offered a reward, I believe. We're trying to get the information. There are many theories. None of them have any evidence behind them right now. So our goal is to try to figure out where this is coming from and to shut it down. And, you know, the sad thing about all this is that we will continue to take steps to make people safer. We're going to spend more money to keep people safer. If people weren't doing this kind of nonsense, that money could go to do positive things in the community to help lift people up. But, you know, we keep having to deal with problems that basically divert resources from moving people forward to put them in the place to be able to protect people. I wish we didn't have to protect people to this degree.
I've got a lot to talk to you about, more school questions. Also, what your expectations are coming from new leadership in Annapolis. Lots to talk about. We're talking with Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Going to take a quick break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast. That's on our website, whur.com. It'll be there after 8:30 tonight. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking to Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich about all things happening in the county. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR, or you can find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. County Executive, again, another school question. The superintendent, Dr. Monifa McKnight, released statistics that seem to be, if I may say, a carbon copy of things that we've seen in the District of Columbia, in Prince George's County, in Fairfax County, and across the nation. The post-COVID educational loss, specifically in math. Now, the statistics said that there was an improvement in graduation rates and enrollment, but math not doing well. Talk to me about that.
So I'm a former elementary school teacher, mm-hmm, with a particular fondness for math. And I'll say that, you know, during the COVID period, and if you were doing stuff on Zoom, it was one thing to deal with language because you can process auditorially, you know, what you also are reading. And it is, I think, easier to connect words spoken and written because it's pretty straightforward. And if the kid doesn't understand the word or know the word, you can say that word is this. Many times they'll understand it when they hear it pronounced correctly. So without getting too much into that end of the experience, math is much more of a hands-on thing. So it was normal in the classroom I would be in that I would spend a lot of time going from desk to desk to look at the work somebody was doing and to help them, you know, explain to them, A, what they need to do if they were completely lost, but also, you know, help them self-correct. And that got lost when COVID, during the period of time when people weren't in school. And if you understand curriculum, the fifth grade curriculum is built on what you knew in the fourth grade. The fourth grade is built on what you were supposed to get in the third grade. If you missed pieces of that curriculum and then you get put into the fifth grade classroom and somebody wants you to do something, say fractions or percentages, and you haven't learned division, you're not going to get that until you learn division. And if you think about the amount of time you spend a whole year teaching these objectives in third grade, then you get another set that takes a whole year to teach. And now you're with a kid who's missed large parts of what they were taught, and or should have been taught or could have been taught, but weren't taught because they weren't in a class. That makes it really hard. And last year's teachers were at a disadvantage because their kids had already missed a year of school in Zoom. The school did, an admirable effort to try to do this via Zoom as much as possible. But some things are harder to convey than others when all you're doing is staring at a screen and you're not going from student to student. And you know, we in hindsight, I could think of things I would have done differently, but hindsight doesn't matter. We are where we are right now. And we, the schools need the support. That's one reason we've put more money in the budget last year, was to help them deal with learning loss. And we understand we need to make a similar commitment again this year.
Specifically, what, other than the financial commitment, what needs to be done to catch students up?
I guess, frankly, I would have looked at the curriculum and I would assess what the kids didn't have, which under an older curriculum was really easy to tell which skills they hadn't mastered, and focus on giving them the skills they need, the precursors they need for what you're going to try to instruct in the grade you're in right now. Just thinking that a teacher can do all of that without like a concentrated effort, it wasn't like these kids learned the stuff instantly, otherwise you could have learned everything in 1 year. And so they missed a lot of time trying to learn the things they needed, and there's got to be some accommodation for that lost time in terms of giving them more time to do the work that's at their level. And so if you think about a curriculum and everything you teach during the day, you could ask yourself, could I spend less time on social studies and science maybe than on fundamentals like reading and math? I mean, it's one of the things that I would think of. But those are, you know, things the school system's got to figure out. How do you get them a level of intensity of instruction to make up for what they didn't get, and then enable them to deal with what you expect them to deal with now?
Let's talk about affordable housing. There was a groundbreaking last week for, a 200-unit development on Randolph Road near Veers Mill Road. Affordable housing has, dare I say, a thorn in the side of every county executive for the past 30 years and even more in Montgomery County. What do you believe this development symbolizes? I would imagine once it's built, it'll probably be sold and rented before the last brick is laid.
Hopefully it will. Well, this project actually includes ownership units, and we're trying to push our developments into greater and greater amounts of ownership. And we don't always, our partners aren't always used to me. Most of the nonprofits deal in rental rather than ownership properties, so we need a mindset change. You're not going to deal with generational wealth issues if you do not provide ownership opportunities, because as we all know, people who rent are paying almost as much as people, if not more, who buy. So it's not like this is a cheaper option. It's an option that's available to people who don't have 20% of a $500,000 house to put down a down payment. So it's not saving anybody any money, and it is a struggle for people to get through it. Plus, if you're a homeowner, your mortgage is flat. If you're a renter, your rent's going up every year, so you don't even have the stability of a homeowner. So one of our goals was to push more affordability in the project. Another one of the goals was to get more affordability total. So normally, if a developer does something, we get a whopping 12.5% to 15% of the total development is affordable. It's only affordable to a narrow band of people. If you make less than 50, I got nothing for you. If you make more than 80, I probably don't have anything for you either, and you're not going to be able to afford the market. So we're trying to expand the band of people that we serve as we go forward. I think people know we've put 18 or 19 parking lots that we own on the market. We're not looking to sell them per se, but it will make deals with people who give us good development proposals that have this very, very wide range of affordability. And we're also preferencing, we want more 3 and 4 bedrooms. So this project on Veers Mill Road actually had 3 and 4 bedrooms, which we never produce. If you look at what's happening in Bethesda, almost everything in Bethesda is a 1 and 2 bedroom apartment. So no families going there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can say what you want about what that's about, but it really keeps them out. And if you think about the affordability levels, if you make less than $60,000, you're pretty much not going to get in. If you're over 80, you not only aren't going to get in, but the jump between an affordable subsidized unit, say a 2-bedroom that we have, be about $1,800, and a market rate 2-bedroom unit in a new building in Bethesda, you're looking at $3,500, $4,000. Mm. So there's nothing for that gap in between. So we're going to try to, on our pieces of property, start filling in the gaps at both ends. And we're going to propose some changes to the county's affordable housing policy. We call it moderately priced dwelling units. We're going to rename it something that I think is more fitting, like, you know, building complete communities, so that anybody in Montgomery County should be able to find something in downtown Bethesda. It can't be a place where it's all high-end luxury with whatever few units you have to give the county so that you can say, I met my affordable housing commitment. It's not enough.
Speaking of housing and the quality of life, and I asked you this, I think, the last time you were here, about downtown Silver Spring. Do you have any proposed changes to address what appears to be a rise in crime there? It, you know, Silver Spring has always, you know, been, when you talk about Montgomery County's urban, suburban district, it was supposed to be this gem. And yet now, even during the pandemic, it was problematic there.
So I think, you know, Silver Spring's gone through this story twice. When they were trying to do the development that ultimately came into Silver Spring, they completely denigrated Silver Spring and made it sound like, you know, it was a nightmare. You know, it was not, it didn't have the opportunities and shopping that other places, the mall, the shops that were in Silver Spring left Silver Spring to go to malls, leaving Silver Spring without the kind of retail and core that would draw more people there and draw more business there. We've got businesses in Silver Spring, but we absolutely had an uptick in crime. The Silver Spring statistics can be deceiving because Silver Spring includes everything up to Burtonsville and way up north in the county. So it's not like downtown Bethesda, which is pretty much, you know what downtown Bethesda looks like.
It starts here, ends here, and that's kind of
so,
it.
Yeah. So some of it's a statistical thing, but the other part of it is real, and we hear these stories. So we have put in a major invested. We have worked with the folks in the nighttime economy whose businesses we think are problematic, and we've put them through inspections. We've made it very clear that these are the regs you're expected to follow, and we're going to continue to enforce. We've put cameras in Silver Spring. I never thought we'd have cameras like we've got cameras, but we've put cameras in. And we had to overcome some resistance for, you know, obviously this is far more surveillance than people are used to, but it's also less level of comfort than people are used to. So we've done that. Our police department is, you know, been willing to move people from other places to beef up what we have in Silver Spring, but that has limited utility because we're short-staffed. It doesn't help to create a hole someplace else in the county to fill this hole. We've contracted with a private provider to support homelessness services. One of the things we find, this is generically true, is that our police spend far too much time dealing with things that really shouldn't be criminal and shouldn't be the purview of the police. But they're who you call if somebody is disorderly or doing unpleasant things and you have to deal with it. So we've got more mental health workers. We're putting in more mobile teams to be able to respond to these types of responses to take some of that load off the police. And we increased our pay, and we have a larger recruit class. We're going to continue to make sure that our pay makes us competitive. We had fallen to the bottom, and my first effort to raise pay was not successful. My second one was. So we're going to do the things we need to do to make sure we get back to staffing levels that will enhance public safety. And we're going to continue to do things like the license plate readers and the cameras. Mm-hmm. And there will be more cameras. We had a discussion about this today in order to increase the level of safety that people feel. Mm-hmm. And we need more, you know, we really need more people on the ground, which is why it's important to get our police back up to full staffing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the cameras just provide evidence of a crime. They don't serve a preventative purpose.
Have you had a chance to sit down one-on-one with Governor Westmore yet?
Haven't sat one-on-one in a prolonged meeting. We've talked about getting meetings set up, and our staff's working with his staff to do that. But I've had numerous conversations with him, and, you know, all of that makes me very optimistic.
What's your ask of the governor? Every county executive has an ask when there's a new administration, or even when there's a new budget cycle and the administration is the same?
So I think there are a number of things that we're really poised to do and can do better than a lot of places can do. We, on the environmental front, we have lots of projects underway. We've got a bus rapid transit system underway that is critical to economic development in the county. And I think the governor, who understands business very well, understands that if you don't have an adequate transit system that moves customers and workers to the workplaces, you're not going to be as successful as you could be. And you can look across the river and see what they were able to build that Montgomery County doesn't have the resources to build. And hopefully that we will be able to convince them to make some investments there. We have a new project. It's called the Institute for Health Computing in conjunction with the University of Maryland, UMBC, and also the University of Maryland Medical System, which is going to bring artificial intelligence and all the things that come with it to research for our life sciences industries to help move those forward, which are really a signature for the county. And we're very optimistic this is happening in the White Flint, North Bethesda area. WMATA is bringing in a master developer to focus on bringing life sciences companies there so we can create a real life sciences hub on a metro in Montgomery County. And we need the governor to be able to support the infrastructure. Much as previous governor was willing to put in infrastructure for Amazon, this is more important than Amazon. It is likely to be bigger than Amazon's footprint over the next 10 years, but we need the right support for it. We need support for our schools. So part of dealing with learning loss, you know, a lot of the money's coming out of the county, but the state needs to step up. And I'm not the only county who feels this way. Same thing on school construction. We got hammered by inflation. The projects we were going to build last year with our budget aren't buildable this year unless we decide to cut some projects out. And that wouldn't have to do if the governor looks at some of the surplus the state is carrying right now and can help support not just the counties, but all the counties that have been hit by these, you know, really big inflation increases. Those are big issues for us.
Are you ready for recreational marijuana in Montgomery County? So you could argue it's already there, just depending on which side of town you're driving or walking on. But now that it is, you know, legal, and the governor has, you know, signed, this money order. It's a heck of a money order, to begin to develop the resources to address that. What is your concern about that?
My concern is, you know, uncontrolled sales. I've advocated that the county be allowed to sell like we sell liquor, because we wouldn't sell the children. We're not private. You know, you don't have to worry about what we're going to do. I would not allow advertising of marijuana. And I believe this should have been legal for the last, God knows, many years of my life. But there's no reason to advertise it. There's no reason to promote it. I don't want kids picking up ads and reading that, you know, if you come here and you smoke this, this is going to give you the most amazing experience of your life. They don't need to see that. They don't need to be encouraged to do it. We made that mistake with alcohol. You know, you glorify alcohol, you get people drinking too much. You make cigarettes look like something everybody does, you get too many people smoking. We ought to learn from these last two experiences with drugs that are legalized, and actually with this drug, take a little bit more cautious approach in how it gets promoted. And frankly, if the counties were the ones that controlled the sales, we would have a lot of money to put back into social programs. We could fund mental health programs that we struggle to fund right now. And I don't understand why I would create a bunch of millionaires in a business that doesn't exist today, when I could take I could take millions and millions of dollars and put it into social programs that the county needs. I think, you know, we're going to have to deal with, you know, how you're going to test for drivers. And, you know, frankly, you're not going to be allowed to smoke it on the street when you're walking around. I know it's incredibly hard to control, but we don't allow people to drink on the street. And we've got to tell people who want to smoke that this is like drinking. I'm not going to let you out here with a vodka bottle filling your cup. you can't be out here doing this, and you can't impose the drug on somebody else, which is the other risk in the public. If you can smoke at a restaurant or you can smoke on a in a public place, then people don't want to get high are going to get exposed to it. And we ought to have enough respect for people, just like we say with cigarette smoke. You know, there are places you can't smoke. We should say these are places you can't smoke. And it's legal in other places, and it's fine, and nobody's going to bother you. But if I were a parent and I was in a place where I felt like with my kids, that I'm going to have little kids that are exposed to marijuana smoke, I probably wouldn't want that. I don't want to make places undesirable for families and people to congregate because people feel they can smoke anywhere they want. And coming from me, who really has never had an objection to this, I mean, I'm looking at this as realistically, it's not about an individual's personal desire to smoke, but it's like you have to have some responsibility for the consequences of what you're doing on the people around you.
Mm-hmm. We've spoken about crime. We've spoken about education. And you are, you know, at the beginning of a very, very hard one new term. What is your, other than the things we've already discussed, what other kinds of initiatives do you want to perhaps see in the county that you've not done yet?
So what we're looking at doing is accelerating our economic development profile. What we realized, and what I realized painfully, was that people had very little idea what we do. And part of it is that I'm invisible to the post most of the time, unless they want something ugly to say. But other than that, you know, they don't know what we're doing. When we had this groundbreaking for the University of Maryland Medical System, one of the biggest things that Forbes covered, mm-hmm. Washington Post didn't bother to cover it. Mm. So says a lot about the Post. I want to be sure that people understand what we're doing. That would give businesses more confidence if they understood what we're doing. We really are trying to drive the attraction of businesses with higher paying jobs, with opportunities for kids to, you know, graduate and stay in Montgomery County. We're trying to bring graduate level research to the county, which we've never had before. We're trying to develop a workforce, and we've, you know, had discussions just today about the ability to do training for biotech manufacturing that does not require a college degree, but is going to provide really good jobs for people. So we're looking at how we grow this economy. I think artificial intelligence, which is a big part of what's going to happen with the medical system and with the University of Maryland, is also going to spin up more AI companies. You don't go a day anymore where somebody's not talking about the value of AI. And I had just a fun experience the other day. I put on that Chat GPT, whatever it is.
Yes.
I got into it.
The artificial intelligence, yes. that same thing that's getting a lot of criticism for reproducing Picasso paintings and everything else. That's a whole nother thing.
But they have this, you know, algorithm where you can talk to it in natural language and it'll create the code that you could put into a computer. So I just said to it, I said, create a program where I turn off my computer at 1 a.m. and I turn it on at 7 a.m. Within 10 seconds, spit out the lines of code that I would need to copy and put into a program on my computer.
Wow.
This is why, you know, these are reasons to be optimistic, because the amount of knowledge we're dealing with and our ability to understand and transform things is growing. Unfortunately, our maturity and sanity appear to be somewhat at risk. And we're not really thinking, you know, I think too many people are pessimistic about the future. And so everything seems like a dark downward spiral to them. It's not good to feel that way. I think if people understood what we're capable of and thought about why don't we do something as opposed to why is this happening to us, things don't have to happen to us. We need in some way in this society to take more control of our destinies and say, this is what we want. This is what we're going to build. Tell me how to build it. Don't tell me about the bad stuff. That's going to happen anyway. Tell me how to get us to a place where we're all going to feel safer, better, happier.
You received a lot of slings and arrows during the pandemic as it relates to COVID restrictions and the like. COVID is still with us. let's talk about, you know, the COVID numbers in the county. I would imagine they're not where you want them to be. Even the FDA is suggesting that COVID vaccinations be like flu vaccines once a year for those who are unvaccinated.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about COVID, it's different than the flu, is that what, there are several strains of flu, and every year they make up a batch that they think matches which flus are going to come around. COVID changes multiple times during the year, so it's been harder to have vaccines that reflect the latest version of COVID, and by the time you have that vaccine out there, there'll be another version of COVID. So I do believe we're going to need annual vaccines until somebody comes up with a vaccine that prevents everything in the COVID family, which they're actually working on, so that you've got a more universal vaccine than rather than ones that are now tailored to particular versions of the virus or families of the virus. The good news is, because so many people have been vaccinated, and those that weren't got sick and have some natural immunity to COVID, that we're not seeing the deaths that we saw before. We still, I mean, to remind people that we just talked about this last week, state of Maryland, I think since November or something, had like 43 COVID deaths. Maybe it was Montgomery County, but there was like 500 COVID deaths in the state. Whatever the number was, there was a gross, there are far more deaths from the flu than there are, there are far more deaths from COVID than there are from the flu. So this is not like the flu. This will still kill more people that need to die. And as we try to remind people, if you got a vaccine, you're pretty much not going to die. You may get sick. And I'm not, you know, there's, it's definitely clear that COVID can jump the vaccine barrier and make you sick. But the vaccines offer protection against getting really sick and dying. And so I would opt for, you know, taking the vaccine and knowing that if I get sick, I'm highly unlikely to die, whereas taking my chances as an unvaccinated person and realizing you have a much higher risk of dying. So, like, literally, nobody really needs to die from this anymore if everybody would just get their stupid shots and resign themselves to this, how we have to deal with this virus. It's not like there's a fiendish government plot to create a virus. It is here, and it's going to keep changing, and we need to stay on top of it.
The Montgomery County Council has changed. It is bigger. There are, for the first time in its history, more women than men on the county council. How would you characterize your relationship with the new council? What do you hope to do to get out of that? Is this going to be, is this a more the merrier, or is this more folks to deal with?
I think it's more different folks to deal with. It's, you know, starting out less politicized. I mean, there were people who knew what they were going to do the moment I got elected. And so I'm not surprised at some of the stuff. I think, you know, people who are new on the council are going to focus on how do we make this county a better place. I know from what a lot of them ran on, and that there's a lot of synergies with the kind of things that we've been talking about. So some of our discussions, even rent stabilization is a classic example. When I was on the council, I wrote two versions of rent stabilization law. I couldn't get a single council member to walk in my office and say, hey, talk to me about this. I thought it was interesting. Is there something you could do? You know, I'd like to see this. I didn't even have those conversations. I've been in robust conversations with people about, you know, what a law might look like. We were sending over a draft. We sent over a summary of what the law would do. We think there are more people who want to have the discussion. And I think change is, you know, change is a lot more possible when there's a willingness to talk about things. And when things are dismissed without talking, you pretty much guarantee that nothing's going to change. I look at the housing crisis and, you know, we keep doing what we've done all along. You know, if this was a crisis, I was on Tacoma Park City Council. Every year when I was on the council, you had to declare there was an affordable housing crisis. So this goes back to 1987 for me. So we could do this every year. The idea that we've had a crisis since the 80s, and then people say, oh, we got this crisis. It's like, folks, if you've got a crisis for 40 plus years, it's not a crisis, because you haven't done anything to change what you do. So we're proposing changes and how we approach some of these problems so that we can actually produce results. I think this council is going to be open to having those discussions, and we're not always going to agree, And that's just, you know, normal part of life. I don't expect that. I don't surround myself with people who agree with me because I could just look in a mirror if that's all I wanted. You know? So what you want is people, you know, who will engage in a discussion and try to get to the same kind of place, which is a better, more prosperous and inclusive county. And I think that this council is going to be able to have those kinds of discussions. So I'm optimistic.
And hopefully they will be able to work amongst themselves as well, because as I said, there are more of them, and you know, as with any legislative body, as we have seen, there are always going to be challenges.
I pushed increasing the size of the council. Yeah. It wasn't popular when it first came up, but I thought you'd get more diversity if we had more people on the council, if we had more districts, because our districts had gotten very large. Like almost more than 200,000 people in the five districts, with seven, it's smaller now. I would have gone large. I would have done nine districts and two at large. Because, look, I think the more access and accountability you have, the better.
Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich, thank you so much for talking to us. I appreciate your time as always.
Thank you. Sure. I appreciate coming on the show and talking to you. And, you know, I know your listeners are engaged all over the Washington region, so it's a good thing.
We all have these porous borders, and so we have to deal with all of these issues county to county and even in the district. Thank you so much. Thank I appreciate you. Your time. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, January 23rd, 2023. I'm Harold Fisher.